March 13th, 1962. Lyman Lemnitzer, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, presents a proposal to Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara named Operation Northwoods. The document proposed staging terrorist attacks in and around Guantanamo Bay to provide a pretext for military intervention in Cuba. The plans included starting rumors about Cuba using clandestine radio, landing friendly Cubans inside the base to stage attacks, starting riots at the main gate, blowing up ammunition inside the base, starting fires, sabotaging aircraft and ships on the base, bombing the base with mortar shells, sinking a ship outside the entrance, staging funerals for mock victims, staging a terror campaign in Miami, Florida and Washington, D.C., and finally, destroying a drone aircraft over Cuban waters. The passengers, federal agents in reality, would allegedly be college students on vacation. A plane at Eglin Air Force Base would be painted and numbered as a duplicate of a registered civil aircraft belonging to a CIA front in Miami. The duplicate would be substituted for the real plane and loaded with the passengers. The real plane would be converted into a drone. The two planes would rendezvous south of Florida. The passenger-laden plane would land at Eglin Air Force Base to evacuate its passengers and return to its original status. The drone would pick up the scheduled flight plan and, over Cuban waters, transmit a Mayday signal before being blown up by remote control. The plan is rejected by McNamara, and President John F. Kennedy personally removes Lemnitzer as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. December 1st, 1984. A remote-controlled Boeing 720 takes off from Edwards Air Force Base and is crash-landed by NASA for fuel research. Before its destruction, the plane flew a total of 16 hours and 22 minutes, including 10 takeoffs, 69 approaches, and 13 landings. August 1997. The cover of FEMA's Emergency Response to Terrorism depicts the World Trade Center in crosshairs. February 28, 1998. The Global Hawk, Raytheon's unmanned aircraft vehicle, completes its first flight over Edwards Air Force Base in California at an altitude of 32,000 feet, cruising altitude for a commercial jetliner. 1999. NORAD begins conducting exercises in which hijacked airliners are flown into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. June 2000. The Department of Justice releases a terrorism manual with the World Trade Center in crosshairs. September 2000. The Project for a New American Century, a neoconservative think tank whose members include Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Jeb Bush, and Paul Wolfowitz, releases their report entitled Rebuilding America's Defenses. In it, they declare that the process of transformation, even if it brings revolutionary change, is likely to be a long one, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event, like a new Pearl Harbor. October 24th, 2000. The Pentagon conducts the first of two training exercises called Mascow, which simulate a Boeing 757 crashing into the building. Charles Burlingame, an ex-Navy F-4 pilot who worked in the Pentagon, participates in this exercise before retiring to take a job at American Airlines, where, less than a year later, his Boeing 757 allegedly crashes into the building. April 2001. NORAD plans an exercise in which a plane is flown into the Pentagon, but is rejected as too unrealistic. June 2001. The Department of Defense initiates new instructions for military intervention in the case of a hijacking. It states that for all non-immediate responses, the Department of Defense must get permission directly from the Secretary of Defense. Attorney General John Ashcroft begins flying on chartered jets for the remainder of his term due to a threat assessment by the FBI. July 4th, 2001. Osama bin Laden, wanted by the United States since 1998, receives medical attention at the American Hospital in Dubai, where he is visited by a local chief of the CIA. July 24th, 2001. Larry A. Silverstein, who already owned World Trade Center 7, signs a $3.2 billion, 99-year lease on the entire World Trade Center complex 6 weeks before 9/11. Included in the lease is a $3.5 billion insurance policy, specifically covering acts of terrorism. September 6, 2001, 3,150 put options are placed on United Airlines stock. A put option is a bet that a stock will fall. That day, put options were more than four times its daily average. Bomb-sniffing dogs are pulled from the World Trade Center, and security guards end 2 weeks of 12-hour shifts. September 7th, 2001. 27,294 put options are placed on Boeing's stock, more than five times the daily average. September 10th, 2001. 4,516 put options are placed on American Airlines, almost 11 times its daily average. Newsweek reports that a number of top Pentagon brass canceled their flight plans for the next morning. San Francisco Mayor Willie Brown receives a phone call warning him not to fly the next morning. Pacifica Radio later reveals that this phone call came directly from National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice. And in Pakistan, at a military hospital, all of the urologists are replaced by a special team in order to host their guest of honor, Osama bin Laden, who is carefully escorted inside to be watched carefully and looked after. September 11th, 2001. The National Reconnaissance Office in Chantilly, Virginia, is preparing for an exercise in which a small corporate jet crashes into their building. NORAD is in the middle of a number of military exercises. The first, Vigilant Guardian, is described as an exercise that would pose an imaginary crisis to North American air defense outposts nationwide. The second, Northern Vigilance, moved fighter jets to Canada and Alaska to fight off an imaginary Russian fleet. Three F-16s from Washington, D.C.'s National Guard at Andrews Air Force Base, 15 miles from the Pentagon, are flown 180 nautical miles away for a training mission in North Carolina. This left 14 fighter jets to protect the entire United States.
Hi, Boston Center, TMU. We have a problem here. We have a hijacked aircraft headed towards New York, and we need you guys to, we need someone to scramble some F-16s or something up there to help us out.
Is this real world or exercise?
No, this is not an exercise, not a test.
Do we want to think about scrambling aircraft?
God, I don't know.
That's a decision somebody's going to have to make probably in the next 10 minutes.
Everybody just left the room.
The first question I have is basically to get from you a sense of how you would rate the American media in their coverage of the events of the attack last September.
Well, let's see. Shamefully is a word that comes to mind.
This just in, you are looking at obviously a very disturbing live shot there. That is the World Trade Center, and we have unconfirmed reports this morning that a plane has crashed into one of the towers of the World Trade Center.
But overall, the American journalism was cowed and intimidated by this massive flag-sucking, this patriotic orgy. You know, if you criticize the president, it's unpatriotic and there's something wrong with you, you may be a terrorist.
So in that sense, Hunter S. Thompson, there's not enough room for dissenting voices?
Well, there's plenty of room. There's just not enough people are willing to take the risk.
Jim, I don't know whether we've confirmed that this was an aircraft, or to be more specific, some people said they saw a missile.
There was definitely a blue logo. It was like a circular logo on the front of the plane. It definitely did not look like a commercial plane. I didn't see any windows on the side.
Mark, if what you say is true, those could be cargo planes. You said you didn't see any windows in the side?
I didn't see any windows on the side. It was not a normal flight that I've ever seen at an airport. It was a plane that had a blue logo on the front, and it did not look like it belonged in this area.
It's just sort of a herd mentality, a lemming-like mentality. If you don't go with the flow, you're anti-American, therefore a suspect.
This is as close as we can get to the base of the World Trade Center. You can see the firemen assembled here, the police officers, FBI agents, and you can see the two towers. A huge explosion now, raining debris on all of us. We better get out of the way!
Sort of wonder when something like that happens, well, who stands to benefit? You know, who had the opportunity and the motive You just got to look at these basic things. I don't assume that I know the truth about what went on that day. And, yeah, I just look around and looking for, well, who had the motive, who had the opportunity, who had the equipment, who had the will. I spent enough time on the inside of, well, the White House and administrative campaigns, and I've known enough of the people who do these things to know that the public version of the news, what I'm convinced, is never really with them. And these people, I think, are willing to take that even further.
Seems a very long bow to me, but are you sort of suggesting that this worked in the favour of the Bush administration?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Arlington, Virginia. Hani Hanyor allegedly executes a 330-degree turn at 530 miles per hour, descending 7,000 feet in 2.5 minutes to crash American Airlines Flight 77 into the ground floor of the Pentagon. Its final approach took it directly across Interstate 395. Knocking light poles out of the ground and bouncing off of the lawn before impact. First, let's meet Hani Hanyor. Hanyor had come to Freeway Airport in Bowie, Maryland 1 month earlier seeking to rent a small plane. However, when Hanyor went on 3 test runs in the second week of August, he had trouble controlling and landing a single-engine Cessna 172.
Well, my name is Marcel Bernard, and I'm the chief flight instructor here at Freeway. Hani Hanyor, well, basically what happened with him is he showed up at the airport and wanted to get checked out in the aircraft. See, he was already certified. He didn't come to us for flight training.
Yeah, he already had a pilot's license.
He had already earned his private instrument commercial at a school in Arizona, and I don't remember the name of the school, but he already had certificates in hand. And we sometimes occasionally have pilots that come to us that don't want flight training but just want to rent our aircraft.
Which is the case of Hani Hanyor.
This is the case of Hani. He wanted to get checked out, as we call it, to rent our aircraft. And our insurance requires that he flies with one of our instructors to be found competent to rent.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the process that he was going through. So, the census was that he was very quiet, average or below average piloting skills.
Mm-hmm.
English was very poor. So I don't know where to. That's about the best description I can get give you for his demeanor.
Mm-hmm.
At times, very, uneventful from my perspective.
Regardless, air traffic controllers at Dulles International Airport that were tracking Flight 77 all thought that it was a military plane. Second, the light poles. On November 22, 2004, a private jet en route to Houston to pick up George Bush Sr. clipped a single light pole and crashed a minute away from landing at Houston's Hobby Airport. The wing ripped off upon impact, scattering debris over 100 yards. And yet,
Flight 77 managed to tear five light poles completely out of the ground without damaging either the wings or the light poles themselves. Instead, they seem to have just popped out of the ground. Third, you only have to look at the photos from that day to realize that whatever hit the Pentagon did not bounce off the lawn. If Flight 77 had crash-landed and skidded into the Pentagon, it would have looked like this. Instead, it looked like this, without a single scratch on the lawn. Fourth, why is there absolutely no trace of Flight 77?
You know, it might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon. The only site is the actual site of the building that's crashed in, and as I said, the only pieces left that you can see are small enough that you could pick up in your hand. There are no large tail sections, wing sections, a fuselage, nothing like that anywhere around, which would indicate that the entire plane crashed into the side of the Pentagon.
The official explanation is that the intense heat from the jet fuel vaporized the entire plane. Indeed, from these pictures, it seems that there is absolutely no trace of a Boeing 757. But if the fire was hot enough to incinerate a jumbo jet, then how can investigators identify 184 out of 189 people found at the Pentagon? The Armed Forces DNA Identification Laboratory, which was responsible for the task, was also responsible for identifying the dead in Shanksville. Keep that in mind for later. So what is a Boeing 757 made of? I called Boeing to ask, but the operator informed me that Boeing refuses to give out any information regarding the construction of their aircraft due to the attacks of September 11th. But what we do know is that a 757 has two Pratt & Whitney engines made of steel and titanium alloy, which are 9 feet in diameter, 12 feet long, and weigh 6 tons each. Titanium has a melting point of 1,688 degrees Celsius. Jet fuel, also known as kerosene, is a hydrocarbon, which can retain a constant temperature of 1,120 degrees Celsius after 40 minutes, but only if the fuel is maintained. The fuel would have burned off immediately upon impact. Therefore, it is scientifically impossible that 12 tons of steel and titanium was vaporized by kerosene. Likewise, the two engines should have been found relatively intact at the Pentagon. Instead, there was a single turbojet engine, approximately 3 feet in diameter, found inside the building. After this photo was published by American Free Press, readers wrote in to suggest that the turbine was a piece from the auxiliary power unit, APU, mounted in the tail section of a 757. Chris Bolin contacted Honeywell in Phoenix, Arizona, the manufacturer of a 757's APU. An expert, speaking on the condition of anonymity, told him that there's no way that that's an APU wheel. Bolin then contacted Pratt & Whitney and Rolls-Royce, the two companies that manufacture 757 engines. Pratt & Whitney pointed Bolin towards Rolls-Royce, and John W. Brown, a spokesman for Rolls-Royce, told Bolin that it is not a part from any Rolls-Royce engine that I'm familiar with. In an article written by Carl Schwartz, president and chief executive officer of Patmos Nanotechnologies, LLC, and Inet Security Systems, he believes that the piece is a JT-8D turbojet engine from a U.S. Air Force A-3 Sky Warrior. The piece in the FEMA photo is the front shaft bearing housing. Jet engines have a center shaft, which must be balanced, as well as bear seals on the front and back. The photo shows the front seal and a rotor hub missing its fan blades. These blades are easily removed in a collision such as the one found at the Pentagon. The United States Air Force has only a few A-3s left in operation, and they are stored in Van Nuys, California, at Hughes Aircraft, which is now better known as Raytheon. So if this piece didn't come from a 757, then where? And where are the engines from Flight 77? The second identifiable piece of debris was allegedly a piece of the fuselage. Skeptics have claimed that this is proof that Flight 77 hit the Pentagon, but this piece could have come from any American Airlines plane. And why is it not singed or scratched after a 530-mile-per-hour impact and the subsequent fireball? The third piece of debris was a diffuser case. Let's look a little closer at the diffuser case of a 757. Do you see the triangular bezels around the openings? Those are nowhere to be found on the case found at the Pentagon. The remainder of the debris was light enough to have been carried by hand, and employees at the Pentagon were seen carrying away a large box, shrouded in a blue tarp. Why the mystery? If Flight 77 was vaporized on impact, it would be the first time in aviation history. For example, August 15, 2005, Helios Airways Flight 522, a Boeing 737 en route to Athens, Greece, crashed into a hillside at full speed. 121 passengers, all dead. Fire. Tail sections. Wing sections. Engines. Cockpit. Bodies. Catch my drift? Fifth, why is the damage to the Pentagon completely inconsistent with a Boeing 757? These photos were taken before the roof of the outer ring had collapsed. The only damage to the outer wall is a single hole, no more than 16 feet in diameter. A Boeing 757 is 155 feet long, 44 feet high, has a 124-foot wingspan, and weighs almost 100 tons. Are we supposed to believe that it disappeared into this hole without leaving any wreckage on the outside? Why is there no damage from where the wings, or the vertical stabilizer, or the engines would have slammed into the building? Remember how big the engines were? If 6 tons of steel and titanium slammed into the Pentagon at 530 miles per hour, they would bury themselves inside the building, leaving 2 very distinct imprints. And yet, the only damage on the outside of the Pentagon is this single hole, with no damage from where the engines would have hit. Why are the windows next to the hole completely intact? Why are the cable spools directly in front of the hole completely untouched? And as for the inside of the Pentagon, there's another hole, approximately 16 feet in diameter, found on the other side of the C-ring, 3 rings from the impact. For that hole to have been caused by Flight 77, the Boeing would have had to smash through 9 feet of steel-reinforced concrete. The nose of a commercial airliner is composed of lightweight carbon. This is what usually happens to the nose of a commercial airliner in a plane crash. If the nose caused this hole, where's the rest of the debris from the plane? So what could blow a 16-foot hole in the outer ring of the Pentagon, smash through 9 feet of steel-reinforced concrete, and leave another 16-foot hole? A cruise missile. This is what Slobodan Milosevic's residence in Belgrade looked like after a Tomahawk cruise missile had hit it. See any similarities? Sixth, the eyewitnesses. Some saw a huge 100-ton commercial airliner.
Standstill, and I looked off. I was, you know, looked out my window. I saw this plane, a jet, American Airlines jet, coming.
Some saw a small 8 to 20 passenger commuter plane.
So it looked to be maybe a 20-passenger corporate jet, no markings on the side, coming in at a shallow.
And some saw a United States military helicopter.
When it occurred, he said that he saw a helicopter circle the building. He said that it appeared to be a U.S. military helicopter and that it disappeared behind the building where the helicopter landing zone is, and that he then saw a fireball go into the sky.
So who's telling the truth? Take this into consideration. April Gallup was working in the Pentagon's west side when it was hit. In Jim Mars's book, Inside Job, April claims, while in the hospital, men in suits visited her more than once. They never identified themselves or what agency they worked for. They didn't tell her what to say, just made suggestions. For example, to take the compensation money and shut up. They also kept insisting that a plane hit the building. They repeated this over and over. But I was there, and I never saw a plane, or even debris from a plane. I figured this story is to brainwash people. So if a Boeing 757 didn't hit the Pentagon, then what did? Eyewitnesses inside and outside the building were thrown to the ground by what they described as a shockwave. Even the Sheraton Hotel, 1.6 miles away, was rocked by the blast. A number of military personnel at the Pentagon specifically mentioned smelling cordite. Cordite and jet fuel have two very distinct smells. Cordite is a compound used in ammunition, which is comprised of nitroguanidine, nitrocellulose, and nitroglycerin. It is cool burning, produces little smoke and no flash, but produces a strong detonation wave. And eyewitnesses described a bright, silvery flash. Jet fuel combustion, i.e., the planes that struck the Twin Towers, is bright yellow at best. Watch this. A massive smoldering fireball. No silvery flash, no shockwave. And at the Pentagon, a tiny, bright, silvery flash, which shakes nearby buildings. Whatever it was, it might have been related to the two planes that were in the air after the crash. The first one was uniformly identified as a C-130. The second plane was an unmarked white plane flying over Washington, D.C.
Aaron, I'm standing in Lafayette Park directly across from the White House, perhaps about 200 yards from the White House residence itself. About 10 minutes ago, there was a white jet circling overhead. Now, you generally don't see planes in the area over the White House. That is restricted airspace. No reason to believe that this jet was there for any nefarious purposes, but the Secret Service was very concerned, pointing up at the jet in the sky. It is out of sight now, best we can tell.
At 9:25, Jane Garvey, the head of the FAA, initiated a national ground stop, which prevents further takeoffs and requires all planes in the air to land. The order, which hasn't been implemented since 1903, applied to almost every single kind of plane. Civilian, military, or law enforcement. Certain military flights were allowed to fly during this time, but the FAA isn't talking. Why were these two planes allowed in the air when everyone else had to land? And finally, why did people keep reporting a second explosion at the Pentagon?
Well, I can't tell you about that, but I was just here in front of the Capitol, which, by the way, has been evacuated. And back toward the Supreme Court area, we just heard a low, muffled thud. It sounded like a small explosion.
There have been unconfirmed reports of second explosions here at the Pentagon. We have not confirmed that. But again, the counterintelligence sources can...
Where did this fireball come from? 7th, surveillance cameras from a gas station, Sheraton Hotel, and the Virginia Department of Transportation captured the entire thing. However, the FBI was there within minutes to confiscate the tapes, including a warning for the employees not to discuss what they had seen. If the government wishes to prove once and for all that Flight 77 hit the Pentagon, all they would have to do is release one of those tapes. Instead, they released 5 frames from a camera across the heliport, even though none of them show a 757. And finally, why do satellite photos taken 4 days before 9/11 show a white marking on the front lawn, marking almost the exact trajectory of whatever hit the Pentagon 4 days later? And is it merely a coincidence that the Pentagon was hit in the only section that was renovated to withstand that very same kind of attack? And that Donald Rumsfeld was safe in his office on the opposite end of the building? If the government has nothing to hide, why are they so afraid to answer a few questions or release a few videos?
:59, New York City, New York. The South Tower of the World Trade Center collapses to the ground in approximately 10 seconds. 29 minutes later, the North Tower follows suit. collapsing in approximately 10 seconds. Later that evening at 5:20, World Trade Center 7, a 47-story office building 300 feet away from the North Tower, suddenly collapses. The building's tenants included the CIA, Department of Defense, IRS, Secret Service, and Rudy Giuliani's emergency bunker. And the SEC was using it to store 3,000 to 4,000 files related to numerous Wall Street investigations. Although every single building surrounding Building 7 stood intact, it fell straight down into a convenient little pile in 6 seconds. Official explanation? Falling debris from the Twin Towers created an internal fire, which ignited several fuel tanks inside the building. If this is true, then it would be the third building in history to collapse because of a fire. The first two would be the Twin Towers. On July 28, 1945, a B-52 bomber lost in the fog crashed into the 79th floor of the Empire State Building. 14 people dead, $1 million in damage, but the building stands intact to this day. On February 14, 1975, a three-alarm fire broke out between the 9th and 14th floors of the North Tower. According to the New York Times, the fire leads to intense scrutiny of the towers and eventually to a decision to install sprinklers. On May 4, 1988, a 62-story skyscraper in Los Angeles burned for 3 hours and spread over 4 floors. It did not collapse. On February 23, 1991, a 38-story skyscraper in Philadelphia, built in 1973, burned for more than 19 hours and spread over 8 floors. It did not collapse. On October 17, 2004, a 56-story skyscraper in Venezuela, built in 1976, burned for over 17 hours and spread over 26 floors, eventually reaching the roof. Guess what? It did not collapse. On February 12, 2005, the Windsor Building in Madrid, a 32-story tower framed in steel-reinforced concrete, burned for almost 24 hours, completely eradicating the upper 10 stories of the building. Although the top 10 floors of the building fell, the building itself did not collapse. And yet, on September 11, 2001, two 110-story skyscrapers, completed in 1973, burned for 56 and 103 minutes, respectively, over 4 floors, before collapsing completely to the ground. One might argue that this was due to the construction of the World Trade Center. Let's look at what was inside those buildings. The Twin Towers were composed of 200,000 tons of steel, 425,000 cubic yards of concrete, 103 elevators, 43,600 windows, 60,000 tons of cooling equipment, and a 360-foot television antenna. The core of each tower was 87 by 133 feet, comprised of 47 box columns 36 by 16 inches thick. The North Tower was completed in 1970, standing at 1,368 feet tall, and the South Tower was completed in 1973, clocking in at 1,362 feet tall, making them the tallest buildings in the world until the Sears Tower was completed in 1974. And to think, the government would have us believe that these massive structures were destroyed by 10,000 gallons of jet fuel. However, eyewitnesses, video footage, and a little common sense quickly refutes that claim. The second plane hits the South Tower between the 78th and 82nd floors at 9:03 a.m. Barely hitting the southeast corner, the majority of the jet fuel exploding outside in a massive fireball. Yet, this tower collapses first, even though the North Tower was hit straight on and had already been burning for 18 minutes longer. Galileo's Law of Falling Bodies calculates the time in which an object will travel a certain distance in complete freefall. Distance, d, equals 16.8 times time in seconds squared. The South Tower was 1,362 feet tall. 1362 equals 16.08 times 84.7, or 9.2 seconds. The Twin Towers came down in nearly free-fall speed. 200,000 tons of steel shatters into sections no longer than a couple feet long. 425,000 cubic yards of concrete is pulverized into dust. Thousands of lives are extinguished instantly. So what brought down the World Trade Center? Let's ask the experts. Van Romero, Vice President for Research at New Mexico Institute of Mining and Technology. My opinion is, based on the videotapes, after the airplanes hit the World Trade Center, there were some explosive devices inside that caused the towers to collapse. The collapses were too methodical to be a chance result of airplanes colliding with the structures. 10 days later, certainly the fire is what caused the building to fail. Why would Romero change his mind so suddenly? Hyman Brown, civil engineering professor and the World Trade Center's construction manager. It was overdesigned to withstand almost anything, including hurricanes, high winds, bombings, and an airplane hitting it. Although the buildings were designed to withstand a 150-year storm and the impact of a Boeing 707, jet fuel burning at 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit weakened the steel. Kevin Ryan, Underwriters Laboratories, the company that certified the steel that was used in the World Trade Center, in a letter to Frank Gale of the National Institute of Standards and Technology. We know that the steel components were certified to ASTM E119. The time temperature curves for this standard required the samples to be exposed to temperatures around 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit for several hours, and as we all agree, the steel applied met those specifications. Additionally, I think we can all agree that even unfireproof steel will not melt until reaching red-hot temperatures of nearly 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Why Dr. Brown would imply that 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit would melt the high-grade steel used in those buildings makes no sense at all. This story just does not add up. If steel from those buildings did soften or melt, I'm sure we can all agree that this was certainly not due to jet fuel fires of any kind, let alone the briefly burning fires in those towers. Ryan's statements directly contradict statements from so-called experts, which claim that 2,000-degree heat inside the World Trade Center caused the towers to collapse. Days after writing this letter, Kevin Ryan was fired from his position. Not even the experts agree with each other. So what else could have caused the Twin Towers and Building 7 to collapse?
10 o'clock Eastern Time this morning, just collapsing on itself.
The second building that was hit by the plane has just completely collapsed.
We have no idea what caused this.
Almost looks like one of those planned implosions.
As if a demolition team set off, when you see the old demolitions of these old buildings, it pulled it down on itself and it is not there anymore.
If you wish to bring anybody who's ever watched a building being demolished on purpose knows that if you're going to do this, you have to get at the under-infrastructure of a building and bring it down.
We heard another explosion, and I'm assuming that's the one that came from the lower level, since there were two. And I said,
right, because it was like 18 minutes apart.
Well, this is the first explosion, and there was a second explosion in the same building. There were two explosions.
Okay.
Federal agencies that were down there do believe that there was some sort of explosive device somewhere else besides the planes hitting.
NBC's Pat Dawson is close to the scene of that attack. Pat?
Just moments ago, I spoke to the chief of safety for the New York City Fire Department, Chief Albert Turry. He received word of the possibility of a secondary device, that is another bomb going off. He tried to get his men out as quickly as he could, but he said that there was another explosion which took place. And then an hour after the first hit here, or the first crash that took place, he said, there was another explosion that took place in one of the towers here. He thinks that there were actually devices that were planted in the building. The second device, he speculates, was probably planted in the building.
There were two or three similar huge explosions, and the building literally shook. You literally shook at the base of this building.
First one and then the other, some say after secondary explosions.
When a big explosion happened, all of a sudden the elevator blew up, smoke. I dragged the guy out, his skin was hanging off, and I dragged him out and I helped him out to the ambulance.
Walking down the stairs, we made it to the 8th floor. Big explosion. Blew us back into the 8th floor.
Just got out of the tunnel and it blew.
The subway tunnel?
Yeah.
Tell us what's happening out there.
We just witnessed some kind of secondary follow-up explosion on the World Trade Center number 2, the one.
Secondary.
We understand now there has been a secondary explosion on Tower 2.
There was another major explosion. The building itself
Literally, the top of it came down, sending smoke and debris everywhere.
Collapsed.
5 blocks from the World Trade Center, and we were standing here when there was some sort of collapse or explosion. Do you know if it was an explosion or if it was a building collapse?
To me, it sounded like an explosion. When I try to say people, in a moment we heard a big explosion coming down. Everything just went black. Everything came down, glass started popping. People got hurt, stuff went on top of them. And it was a big explosion. Everything got dark, real dark, like snow.
The FBI is here, as you can see. They had roped this area off. They were taking photographs and securing this area just prior to that huge explosion that we all heard and felt.
Coming over our radio, get out of the area. The second tower is coming down.
They tell you the second tower is coming.
Yes, it's about to collapse.
At 10:30, I tried to leave the building, but as soon as I got outside, I heard a second explosion and another rumble and more smoke and more dust. I ran inside the building. The chandelier shook, and again, black smoke filled the air. Within another 5 minutes, we were covered again with more silt and more dust. And then a fire marshal came in and said we had to leave because if there was a third explosion, this building might not last.
We just saw that as well. The second tower, the only one that was standing, tower number one, just we saw some kind of explosion, a lot of smoke come out of the top of the tower, and then it collapsed down onto the streets below.
David Lee, what can you tell us?
John, just seconds ago there was a huge explosion, and it appears right now the second World Trade Tower has just collapsed.
One eyewitness was standing among a crowd of people on Church Street, 2.5 blocks from the South Tower, when he saw a number of brief light sources being emitted from inside the building between floors 10 and 15. He saw about 6 of these flashes, accompanied by a crackling sound before the tower collapsed. Ginny Carr was attending a business meeting on the 36th floor of One Liberty Plaza, across the street from the World Trade Center, and caught the entire first attack on tape. A second explosion can be heard 9 seconds after the crash. So what happened in the North Tower? Ask Willie Rodriguez. Willie, a janitor who worked in the World Trade Center for 20 years, was in sub-level 1 when the North Tower was hit.
And all of a sudden, we hear BOOM! I thought it was a generator that blew up on the basement. And I said to myself, oh my God, I think it's a generator. And I was going to verbalize it. When I finished saying that in my mind, I hear BOOM! Right on the top, pretty far away. So it was a difference between coming from the basement and coming from the top. And that's, everybody started screaming, and a person comes running into the office saying, explosion, explosion, explosion. He got his hand extended, and all the skin was pulled from his under his arm, all the way to the top of the fingertips, and it was hanging on both arms. Hanging and hanging. And then I look at his face, and he was missing parts on his face. And I said, what happened? What happened? And he said, the elevators, the elevators. And then there were many explosions. And when I actually talk about those explosions, they said that, well, there were so many kitchens in the building. And they have probably those gas canisters. And I said, I don't believe that because the building was a Class A building. There are very strict guidelines for what you can put in a kitchen. And I really doubt it was gas. So there was a lot of misconceptions of what happened on that day in terms of the explosions. But up to date, I haven't received an actual explanation about the different explosions that I had on the upper floors and not all the way to the top.
The windows in the lobby of the North Tower were blown out. And marble panels were blown off of the walls. This was brushed off as damage from a raging fireball that went barreling down the elevator shafts. However, the World Trade Center's core and elevator shafts were hermetically sealed, aka airtight. The fire could not possibly have had enough oxygen to travel 1,300 feet down, retaining enough energy to destroy the bottom 8 floors of the building. On 9/11, New York City lost 343 firefighters at the World Trade Center. Since they were the ones inside the towers before and as they collapsed, I'd say they've got a pretty good grasp on what happened. So what does the FDNY think? First, we had this interview from the Nade Brothers documentary.
Made it outside. We made it about a block.
We made it at least two blocks, and we started running floor by floor instead of popping out.
It was like, it was if they had detonated.
They were planned
to take down a building. Boom, 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 boom.
All the way down. I was watching it and running.
Just ran up West.
And then you just sort of this cloud of shit chasing you down.
Couldn't just ran up West Street.
In these interviews, numerous members of Engine 7 describe explosions preceding the collapses, not to mention the damage to the lobby of the North Tower.
I heard a loud boom. And my first thing, I was right at the desk there on the left-hand side when you come into Tower 1. And I walked out, you know, I didn't go out. I walked to where all the doorway was, the glass were broken, and I looked out. And I seen in the building across the street, I seen the shadow coming, like the, I seen just the shadow in the building across the street coming down. And with that,
I wasn't expecting to see the damage that I saw in the lobby. And the people, the bodies, the burnt people, the injured people, I really wasn't prepared for that.
The lobby is about six stories high, and the lobby looked as though a bomb had exploded there. It's all the glass was taken out. There were 10-foot by 10-foot marble panels that were once walls. They were loose from the wall of the Trade Center.
I went around by the freight elevator, and I could see it was just blown. It was just a giant shit.
30th floor, we hear another explosion. And at that time, we heard a huge explosion.
Firefighter Louis Caccioli told People Weekly, "I was taking firefighters up in the elevator to the 24th floor to get in position to evacuate workers. On the last trip up, a bomb went off. We think there were bombs set in the building." For more than a year, the Port Authority blocked the release of a tape of firefighters' transmissions from the World Trade Center on 9/11. In November 2002, the tape was finally released to the New York Times and other news outlets. Why did it take so long to get the tape released?
See, I got an eyewitness who said there was an explosion on floor 7-8. 7-8.
We just had another explosion.
Warren Street because of the secondary explosion. We've got numerous people covered with dust from the secondary explosion.
And we've got another explosion on the tower, 1013.
Number two has had a major explosion and what appears to be a complete collapse surrounding the entire area.
Who's involved in the secondary explosion at Tower 1K? I've got five.
Chief Palmer had reached the fire on the 78th floor of the South Tower and devised a plan to put it out.
I saw the pockets of fire. We should be able to knock it down with two lines. Ready, know that. 78th floor, numerous 1045 call horns.
If the 78th floor was a raging inferno like the government would have us believe, then Palmer wouldn't have gotten as far as he did, and certainly wouldn't have been able to put it out. On August 12, 2005, an additional 15 hours of radio transmissions and transcripts of interviews with firefighters was finally released to the public. Firefighters described two events consistent with a controlled demolition: bright flashes from inside the building, and a number of crackling sounds before the building's collapse. What does science have to say about the collapses? The collapse of the World Trade Center was picked up by Columbia University's observatory in Palisades, New York. The South Tower registered as a 2.1 earthquake. The North Tower registered as a 2.3 earthquake. Won Young Kim told Chris Boland that their seismographs pick up underground explosions from a quarry 20 miles away. These blasts are caused by 80,000 pounds of ammonium nitrate and cause local earthquakes between magnitude 1 and 2. The 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center did not even register because it was not coupled to the ground. During the collapse, most of the energy of the falling debris was absorbed by the towers and the neighboring structures, converting them into rubble and dust or causing other damage, but not causing significant ground shaking. Mark Loiseau, the president of Controlled Demolition Incorporated, told the American Free Press that in the basements of the World Trade Center, where 47 central support columns connected to the bedrock, hot spots of literally molten steel were discovered more than a month after September 11th. These incredibly hot areas were found at the bottoms of the elevator shafts, down 7 basement levels. The molten steel was found 3, 4, and 5 weeks later, when the rubble was being removed. He said that molten steel was also found at World Trade Center 7. The highest temperature was in the east corner of the South Tower, where a temperature of 1,377 degrees Fahrenheit was recorded. The molten steel in the basement was more than double that temperature. Do you still think that jet fuel brought down the World Trade Center? In all the videos of the collapses, explosions can be seen bursting from the building 20 to 30 stories below the demolition wave. Here, 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 here. Here. And here. Etienne Saare was filming her documentary, World Trade Center, the first 24 hours, and caught both collapses on tape. Watch carefully. The tripod shakes 12 seconds before the North Tower begins collapsing. And something is knocked off the right-hand side of the building. You're probably asking, if there were bombs in the building, how would they get in there without anyone noticing? Ben Fountain, a financial analyst who worked in the World Trade Center, told People magazine that in the weeks before 9/11, there were a number of unannounced and unusual drills where sections of both the Twin Towers and Building 7 were evacuated for security reasons. Daria Cord, a guard in the North Tower, told Newsday that security detail was working 12-hour shifts for 2 weeks before 9/11, but on Thursday the 6th, bomb-sniffing dogs were abruptly removed from the building. So who authorized all this? President Bush's brother, Marvin, was board of directors at Securicom from 1993 until fiscal year 2000. Securicom, now known as Stratasec, is an electronic security company backed by Kuwait American Corporation, which provided security for United Airlines, Dulles International Airport, and from the early 1990s up to the day of 9/11, the World Trade Center. Marvin is also the former director at HCC Insurance Holdings, which insured parts of the World Trade Center on 9/11. More information on this was supposed to be disclosed and never was. To date, the SEC has not revealed what they have learned. If only we could examine the debris from the World Trade Center and figure out what happened. Unfortunately, Mayor Giuliani began shipping the remains off to recycling yards overseas before investigators could even examine it. Not even FEMA was allowed into Ground Zero. Essentially, they blocked off a crime scene and destroyed all the evidence. Guess who was allowed into the site? Controlled Demolition, who was also responsible for cleaning up after the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995. It gets better than that. On July 15, 2001, Controlled Demolition destroyed two 400-foot-tall fuel reserve tanks from the World War II era. The demolition was conducted for no apparent reason and drew numerous complaints from the neighborhood. The site remains vacant to this day, and a reason for the demolition has never been disclosed. Regardless, I think what happened to the World Trade Center is simple enough. It was brought down in a carefully planned controlled demolition. It was a psychological attack on the American people, and it was pulled off with military precision. 10.06 a.m., Shanksville, Pennsylvania. Flight 93 was en route from New Jersey to California with 45 passengers when it went off course at 8.56 over Cleveland, Ohio. According to the official story, Flight 93 was headed for the White House when it was overpowered by a group of passengers and crashed in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. Out of all of the events of 9/11, the one that has caused the most confusion is Flight 93. It was shot down, it wasn't shot down. However, evidence suggests that perhaps Flight 93 was nowhere near Shanksville.
I want to get quickly to Chris Konicki. He's a photographer with the Pittsburgh affiliate, a Fox affiliate. He was back there just a couple of minutes ago, and Chris, I've seen the pictures. It looks like there's nothing there except for a hole in the ground.
Basically, that's right. The only thing you could see from where we were was a big gouge in the earth and some broken trees. We could see some people walking around in the area, but from where we could see, there wasn't much left.
Any large pieces of debris at all?
No, there was nothing that you could distinguish that a plane had crashed there.
Smoke, fire?
Nothing. It was absolutely quiet. It was actually very quiet. Nothing going on down there. No smoke, no fire. Just a couple of people walking around. They look like part of the NTSB crew walking around looking at the pieces.
How big would you say that hole was?
From my estimates, I would guess it was probably about 20 to 15 feet long and probably about 10 feet long or 10 feet wide.
What could you see on the ground, if anything, other than dirt and ash? And
you couldn't see anything. You could just see dirt, ash, and people walking around, broken trees.
Wally Miller, a Somerset County coroner, told the Houston Chronicle, "It looked like somebody just dropped a bunch of metal out of the sky." In the Washington Post, "It looked like someone took a scrap truck, dug a 10-foot ditch, and dumped trash into it. And as for the passengers, I stopped being coroner after about 20 minutes because there were no bodies there." In the Pittsburgh Review, "I have not, to this day, seen a single drop of blood. Not a drop." It would seem that, on one day, for the second time in history, an entire plane, along with its passengers, disappeared upon impact.
"There are no signs of any survivors at the site of a Nigerian plane crash. That is the word from the Red Cross, which has a representative on site. The first pictures of the crash scene show a large crater with the Boeing 737 broken into small pieces. The plane crashed shortly after taking off from Lagos in a heavy storm. The flight was going to the Nigerian capital of Abuja and was believed to be carrying some senior Nigerian officials."
So if Flight 93 didn't go down in Shanksville, then where? You ready for this? Cleveland. At 11:43 on September 11th, WCPO, a local TV station in Cincinnati, Ohio, reported that two planes landed at Cleveland Hopkins Airport due to a bomb threat. United Airlines identified one of the planes as Flight 93. Are you confused? Well, it gets better. Check it out. At approximately 10 a.m., Cleveland Hopkins Airport was evacuated amidst rumors that a hijacked plane was going to land. Passengers had to leave, but couldn't drive. They had to walk or hitchhike. Buses weren't allowed to leave. People were sent home. According to Associated Press and local Ohio papers, one plane landed at approximately 10:45. But Delta Airlines confirmed that their plane, Delta 1989, landed in Cleveland at 10:10. Therefore, Flight 93 landed at Cleveland at approximately 10:45. Authorities searched Delta 1989 for over 2 hours, and passengers were questioned individually. The plane dealer reported that the plane was evacuated at 12:30. But the Akron Beacon reports that a plane was evacuated at 11:15, which would make that Flight 93. Mayor White reported that the plane had 200 passengers. But a passenger from Delta 1989 described 60 or so passengers. So at 11:15, 200 or so passengers were released from Flight 93. The passenger from Delta 1989 states that she was taken into FAA headquarters. But other reports say that passengers were brought into the NASA Glenn Research Center, located near the west end of the airport, which had already been evacuated. So, to sum up, Delta 1989 landed at 10:10, was evacuated at 12:30, almost 2.5 hours later, and 69 passengers were taken to FAA headquarters. Flight 93 landed at 10:45 and evacuated within a half hour. 200 or so passengers quickly taken to an empty NASA Research Center.
Why did it take 140 minutes to evacuate 69 passengers when 200 were evacuated in a half hour? We can assume that the passengers from Delta 1989 are safe somewhere. The question remains, what happened to the 200 or so passengers from Flight 93? It's interesting to note that the combined total of all the passengers from all four flights is 198, or 243, depending on who you ask. We may never know what really happened to Flight 93, but we do know what didn't happen. Whenever this evidence is presented to people, you'll usually get one of many different questions. The first one being, if different planes were used, what happened to the original ones? Unfortunately, we may never know what really happened. But if we could examine the black boxes from the planes that were used, we could prove that they weren't the original flights. A commercial plane carries two different black boxes. Each black box carries one of two different recorders. A cockpit voice recorder, and a flight data recorder. The cockpit voice recorder records sounds from inside the cockpit, including engine noise, stall warnings, and other sounds of interest. Communications between air traffic control, weather briefings, and conversations between pilots and crew are also recorded. The flight data recorder records at least 28 different parameters, such as time, altitude, speed, and heading. Some also record more than 300 other in-flight characteristics, anything from autopilot to smoke alarms. The recorders themselves are made from the most impervious metals known to man, and the information is recorded along with date and time, and spooled into a continuous roll. Any damage that is done to the roll is done to the outside, as opposed to the inside where the data is. The 9/11 Commission says that CVRs and FDRs from American 11 and United 175 were not found. Yet, the FBI claims to have found the passport of Saddam al-Sakami, which managed to fly out of his pocket, through the explosion, and onto the streets of Manhattan below. So, four different black boxes, made from the most resilient materials known to man, were destroyed. Yet, a passport, made from a fragile material known as paper, managed to survive? Who writes this stuff? Ted LaPatrick. Spokesman for the National Transportation Safety Board told CBS News that it's extremely rare that we don't get the recorders back. I can't recall another domestic case in which we did not recover the recorders. Turns out Ted's right. Nicholas DeMassey, a firefighter who helped the recovery efforts, claims in the book Behind the Scenes, Ground Zero, "At one point, I was assigned to take federal agents around the site to search for the black boxes from the planes. There were a total of four black boxes. We found three." I guess it all comes down to who you'd rather believe. FBI Director Robert Mueller said Flight 77's data recorder provided altitude, speed, headings, and other information, but the voice recorder contained nothing useful. And Donald Rumsfeld said the data on the cockpit voice recorder was unrecoverable. As for Flight 93, it was the only flight where the cockpit voice recorder was recovered. It was played for the families in April 2002, but not before they signed an agreement saying that they wouldn't talk about it. They couldn't even take notes. And for some reason, the last 3 minutes of the tape was unaccounted for. The FBI had no explanation for the discrepancy. Why would the 9/11 Commission tell us Flight 11 and 175's recorders weren't found? Why would Robert Mueller tell us that there's nothing interesting on Flight 77's? What's on the last 3 minutes of Flight 93's cockpit voice recorder? These are vital questions that need to be answered. It's an interesting postscript that Flight 93 was spotted on April 10, 2003 at Chicago's O'Hare Airport by David Friedman, a United Airlines employee who records all of his flights. The tail number, N591UA, was spotted on Flight 1111, a United Airlines 757. And according to the FAA, both N591UA and N612UA, Flights 93 and 175, are still valid. But Flights 11 and 77 are listed as destroyed. not to mention that they were not even scheduled to fly on September 11th. Next, what about the cell phone calls? For starters, the calls themselves are extremely peculiar. Most of them are only a couple sentences long before the callers end the conversation, only to call back later. Flight attendant Betty Ong allegedly placed a call from Flight 11. According to the 9/11 Commission, although the conversation lasted 23 minutes, only 4.5 minutes was recorded.
What is your name?
Okay, my name is Betty Ong. I'm number 3 on Flight 11.
Okay.
And the cockpit is not answering their phone. And there's somebody staffed in business class, and we can't breathe in business class. Somebody's got mace or something. Okay. Our number 1 got stabbed. Our purser is stabbed. Nobody knows who's stabbed who, and we can't even get up to business class right now because nobody can breathe. Our number 1 is stabbed right now.
Okay.
And our number 5, our first class passengers, galley flight attendant and our purser has been stabbed, and we can't get up to the cockpit. The door won't open.
Does Miss Ong sound like a woman on a hijacked plane who just saw 3 people murdered? Why is nobody in the background screaming? Flight attendant Madeline Sweeney allegedly talked with her ground manager Michael Woodward for 25 minutes. She describes 4 hijackers. The FBI says there were 5. She says the hijackers were in rows 9 and 10. The FAA says they were all in row 8. Near the end, she screams, "I see buildings. Water. Oh my God!" Madeline was a flight attendant out of Boston for 12 years. I think she would have recognized Manhattan. A man claiming to be Mark Bingham called his mother Alice, who is visiting his sister-in-law. The caller says, "Mom, this is Mark Bingham. When was the last time you called your mother and used your full name? I just want to tell you that I love you. I'm on a flight from Newark to San Francisco, and there are 3 guys on board, and they say they've taken over the plane, and they say they have a bomb. I'm calling you from the airphone." And then, "You believe me, don't you, Mom?" "Yes, Mark, I believe you. Who are these guys?" Then he was interrupted by someone who was speaking in a low-toned male voice, speaking what sounded like English. After 30 seconds of muffled sounds, the caller repeats, "I'm calling you with an airphone." His mother asks him again, "Who are these guys?" After another pause, he returns and asks again, "You believe me, don't you, Mom?" There was another pause, and the phone just trailed off. To date, none of these calls, except for Betty Ong's call to American Airlines, has been released to the public. But to be honest, none of that matters. Why? Because none of these calls could have taken place. Key Dudney of physics911.net conducted some research of his own. In an experiment called Project Achilles, he took a series of cell phones onto a Cessna 172 and flew up to 8,000 feet to determine the success rate as the plane got higher. At 4,000 feet, he had a 0.4 success rate. At 8,000 feet, he had a 0.1 success rate. For 32,000 feet, cruising altitude for a commercial airliner, he calculated a 0.006 success rate, less than 1/100th of a chance. Don't believe me? Even American Airlines has put their foot in the government's mouth. On July 15, 2004, passengers aboard a commercial American Airlines flight were able to send and receive calls from their cell phones as if they were on the ground, thanks to a cell station that was installed into the plane. It worked great. I called the office, I called my wife, I called a friend in Paris. They all heard me great, and I could hear them loud and clear. Why would American Airlines spend thousands of dollars on this technology in 2004, when cell phones worked so well on September 11th, 2001? The cell phone calls were fake, no question about it. So how is it possible to fake a person's voice? In 1999, the Los Alamos Laboratory in New Mexico revealed their voice morphing technology. General Carl W. Steiner, the former commander-in-chief of United States Special Operations, declared on tape, "Gentlemen, we have called you together to inform you that we are going to overthrow the United States government." Another example was Colin Powell, saying, "I am being treated well by my captors." With just a 10-minute recording of somebody's voice, they are able, in almost real time, to clone someone's speech. Steiner was so impressed, he asked for a copy. So what about the hijackers? On September 14th, 2001, the Department of Justice released the names of the alleged 19 hijackers. But on September 23rd, the BBC reported that Waleed Al-Sherry was alive and well in Casablanca, Morocco.
They also tracked down Abdulaziz Alomari, who was an engineer with Saudi Telecom and lost his passport while studying in Denver. In the same article, FBI Director Robert Mueller admitted that the identity of several of the hijackers is in doubt. So how many hijackers turned up alive? At least 9 of them. Waylam al-Sheri is alive and well. Mohand al-Sheri is alive in Saudi Arabia. Khaled al-Midar is a computer programmer in Mecca. Salem al-Hazmi works at a chemical plant in Yanbu, Saudi Arabia. Saeed al-Ghamdi is training to be a pilot in Tunis. Ahmed al-Nami is an administrative supervisor for Saudi Airlines. We already covered Waleed and Abdulaziz. And last but not least, Mohammed Atta's father claimed to receive a phone call from his son on September 12th. On September 20th and 27th, Mueller admitted on CNN that there is no legal proof to prove the identities of the hijackers. Indeed, after all, not even the official autopsy for Flight 77 lists the hijackers. And the opening paragraph makes no mention of their absence. So, if there's no proof that the hijackers were members of Al-Qaeda, or if they were even on the plane in the first place, what justification do we have for bombing Afghanistan? Oh, that's right. The Bin Laden confession tape. On December 14th, 2001, the government released a tape, allegedly of Bin Laden confessing to the attacks of September 11th, which they claimed to find in a house in Jalalabad, Afghanistan. Except there's a number of things wrong with this tape. 1. The tape itself is of very poor quality. And 2. The man in the video looks and acts nothing like Bin Laden. According to the FBI's website, Osama is left-handed. Yet, in this video, he's writing a note with his right hand. Not to mention he's wearing a gold ring, which is forbidden by Islamic law, and is never mentioned in the FBI's description of him. Compare this video to 4 other pictures of Bin Laden. Does anybody else see a problem here? Until the government can prove without a shadow of a doubt that Al-Qaeda was behind September 11th, the American people have every reason to believe otherwise. And now for the last question.